This is a production of Cornell University.
I'm going to try and remember.
UA meeting, September 24th, 2008.
Okay. We're going to change around the agenda just a little bit because we're going to have a presentation from...
Yael.
From the Child Services Committee. And, but before we get to her, there's a new person among us. Let him introduce himself because I don't have my clipboard at the moment.
Hi everyone, my name is Alexander Frieden. Just found out that I am one of the two new members of the University Assembly as of 5 minutes ago.
Congratulations.
Welcome aboard.
I did. In South Korea.
Glad you're here.
So,
is
welcome.
You run the meeting. Is there
an agenda?
There is, over on the table. Welcome, and I'm sure we'll keep you busy. And is there anything you can talk about that you want to talk about before Lawson's?
I kind of had an idea that I think it would be sort of good to start. I put it as an agenda item 4 here, but just to get a small report from each of our constituent assemblies, you know, a couple minutes, just to kind of keep us fresh of what's going on kind of with the university in our various constituencies. So, is there anybody from the extension? Do we want to start doing that? Do we want to?
Sure.
So, who would like to go first?
SA? Anybody from the SA? How about the GPSA?
We had our 4 meetings 2 weeks ago, assembly meeting last Monday, just this past. And our first meeting we talked about facilities, and this last, most recent meeting we talked about our Geneva campus and ways to, through the Graduate Community Initiative, one of the things that we've put on our priority list is to make greater connections with the Geneva campus and start communications about ways to get them more incorporated with Cornell here. They have the same health plan that we have here, but they have to travel, what, an hour to come to CNX, because this is where they have to get their primary care. So we've been in communication with them about how to make that commute a little easier or a way for the university to make them feel more inclusive since they are a part of Cornell Stanford campus. So that was one of our agenda items for Monday. We also had President Sport from the hospital.
And was that good? Okay.
One of the things that would be nice to add to that, or at least to encourage any of the people who are reporting for, is to put into the report or to think about at least how the university assembly can be helpful in achieving any of the goals that the particular assemblies set for themselves.
And in response to that, one of the things that the GPSA has taken very seriously is the representation that we have interns nationwide. That is, the graduate students that sit on the university assembly report back to the GPSA at our meetings what we discussed, just like we're doing right now. So we're now sharing with you what we discussed at our meeting, and I usually give them a little blurb of what we discussed here in the UA meeting on an as-needed basis, I'll share with them some of our agenda stuff and they'll see some of my notes. If they have more questions, they'll ask me specifically about what exactly we talked about, if it is of relevance to the GPSA, and if they have questions or comments that they want to pull back, it goes through us when they come to our meeting.
Terrific.
Good. For the EA?
The Employee Assembly. On Monday, October 27th, in Barton Hall from, I think, 10 to 2 p.m., The president gives a major address to the staff. And in addition to the president's address this year, though, we're also adding an energy fair. So there's going to be vendors both representatives both from campus and from the greater Ithaca area participating in this energy fair. That is what we're focused on right now. We have our next meeting is actually next Wednesday, but I will actually be away attending a conference in D.C. But anyway, be on the lookout for tomorrow in the paw print. There's going to be some information about the president's address and the energy of the energy fair.
And the date again?
It's Monday, October 27th, in Barton Hall. Is it 10 or 11?
11.
11 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Leon, are they going to be concerned about saving energy on campus and buildings, something like that?
Yes, everything from Cornell to saving energy at home as well. So it's energy from A to Z. We hope that there's going to be, you know, some vendors there. Both Cornell, what's going on regarding energy here, as well as what you can do at home.
Is it correct that both the vacancies and the employee assembly representation to the vacancies from employees to this committee have been filled?
Bill Liddick, he's a member of the university.
Right, and there were two vacant seats.
Yeah.
And I thought I saw on the sign-up sheet that there were two names added. Alex Braden. Oh, it's undergrad. So there's a need for two vacancies.
I think that still exists.
Okay.
I believe there's a potential that one will be filled shortly, but it has to run to the EF.
Fine.
Okay.
Oh, one other thing real quick. What I'll do when that item comes out tomorrow, that's going to be the first public announcement. Can I email it to Amy or to you, and then all of the members of the UA can have that publicity about the fair from the fall for it?
Okay. Actually, Amy will distribute it for me, will she? Okay.
One last item. Last Wednesday, President Scorton gave an address on the challenges of higher education and public service. And that speech, I thought, was tremendous. So that's another thing that I can perhaps email it to Amy, and maybe you could distribute it to the UA members. Okay.
Perfect. Thank you, Lance. Are we ready to hear about the child services today?
Yep. So the child service, the Cornell Child Care Subcommittee of the Family Services Committee has been generating position statements to describe its activities over the last year, and we this fall hope to have them all together to distribute to you and to HR and to the president, the president's office. But one of them is in a complete draft, not yet voted on as final by the committee, but there was inquiry last UA meeting about accessibility to child care services, and particularly with a new center. And so Yael Levitt, a member of the child care committee, and senior research associate at ILR who works on questions of employer-employee relations, among other things, put this together, and it has some answers to the kind of questions that were coming up, that came up last UA meeting. And so, y'all come to present some of that data, and we have copies of the data.
Yes, we have the copies of the tables that I'll show, and I can later give a PowerPoint or the position statement. I didn't think we should yet distribute the position statement since the members of the committee will not vote on it until October 7th. But there's two members of the committee here. That one is Abe Bush, the chair, and one is Amy O'Donnell, and so they can at any point interject and say no. Or sure, yes. So, what I saw myself as doing, just so you'll understand, is really kind of reflecting the deliberations of the committee throughout the year on these issues. And then I asked HR for data, both from the Child Care Center and from the grant, the Child Care Grant, to try and kind of assess affordability issues. So, the committee deliberations kind of was around two issues. One is our focus on the child care center, and to be honest, a lot of the year was dedicated to that new child care center. And we looked at whether all of Cornell constituents, in terms of our deliberations on affordability and access, were served by the new child care center. We were concerned about whether the center was able to serve all the employees and the student groups, and not just the highest earners, the faculty, or the highest staff members, and whether the scheduling and the cost that was proposed for the new child care center was barring some groups from accessing the services. And the next question was looking much more, and we hope to be focusing on it this year more broadly now that the center is open and we really don't have as much impact anymore on it, is whether the Cornell, is the Cornell parent population at large dealing with child care costs and available services. And we have one of our members at the committee is Sue Day Hall, who's at the Child Care Council, and she could tell you that the ratios of services, I think 1 to 4 for infants and 1 to 3 for the other age groups. So that means that in regulated care in Ithaca, only 1 in 4 infants have access to regulated care and 1 in 3. And it might be a bit different now with the center, but not in a major way. So the first thing we looked at is access to and affordability of the new child care center, and the representative for non-exempt staff among them, the lowest earners at Cornell, was both very concerned with costs, and in a minute I could provide you with some data to show that his concerns were very justified. And more than that, he was also very concerned with hours of operations. Most of the people under his kind of purview are people who work non-traditional hours from 5 a.m. to 12 p.m., and the center is open. What is it, 7 to 6?
Yep.
Okay. So really it doesn't serve certain populations at first early morning and early night. Students, both graduate and undergraduate students, were very concerned, again, with cost, given the low stipends of graduate students and the no stipends of undergraduate students. They were pushing and eventually managed to get some part-time slots into the child care center because they, as students, they don't need 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And the one concern that they still have is the need to hold spots over the break, so not to need to pay for spots while they are not here. And that's still an issue because the Horizons can't accommodate that given that it's for-profit organization and can't hold spots without payment. And we can talk a bit more about what are some the possibilities in looking into that. So what I'm providing you here is with a table that shows the interest in the center and the final enrollment as of 2008. And as far as I understand, there's been some shifts in that, but not really. Right, but you can see, what we can see from these data is that the final enrollment generally reflects the interest, the initial interest. And the initial interest was gauged by people were asked basically, sorry, it is very hot. People were invited to interest sessions where the whole Bright Horizon concept and philosophy and the Bright Horizon Center was described to them, and then they had to fill in the form and say, I would be interested. There was no kind of, there's no fee for filling that form, nothing. So there were 439 families that expressed interest. But among them, people who clearly knew that they had other options as well. Eventually, there are 218 families served in this center, and there's only 158 spots, but that's because there's some part-time spots. We can see from these data that faculty have a slightly larger proportion of enrollment than they have in their interest, and we assume that that's because staff and students declined. We don't have numbers to tell you why they declined. Bright Horizon didn't collect that information. We also don't have data yet, but we will have data, I think, early October at the number of people on the waiting list. So it doesn't mean that there's 321 people that are currently on the wait list. That I just want to make clear that this is not the case. We don't know, though, how many people are still on the wait list. The other thing that this table doesn't tell us is really, it doesn't tell us anything about socioeconomic status and affordability. We don't know if the staff that are in there are, you know, the vice provost that has young children, or you know, we don't know who are, well, he wouldn't be eligible because the cap is a hundred. But the point is, we don't know who are the people that are in the center in terms of socioeconomic status. We know that we can tell that maybe about the 48 students, but for the staff and the faculty, we don't know much about whether the staff that declined, the staff that accepted, or the staff that can afford it. To give you some more data, so I think that basically summarizes what I just said. It reflects the interest in the center. There's no information about whether cost or schedule were an issue, but we did receive a few emails anecdotally that told us we declined the spot because we couldn't afford it. And in a minute, you'll see why that might be. Okay, so now what I asked HR to do is to maybe give me some other sort of information that will help engage the socioeconomic status of people looking for child care. And that is table number 3 in your handout. Thank you. So what do we learn from that? The first thing we learn is that the lowest earner, and there are earners who applied for the child grant, child care grant. Does everyone around here know what the child grant care grant is?
No.
The child care grant is a program run by HR for people with income less than $150,000, so you can't apply for the grant. Which what you do is you submit your income, you submit your cost, and there's some sort of formula, and based on that formula, you get a subsidy that goes into your flex account. So presumably those with lower incomes get higher grants, and that's what you can also see. So in this table, what you can see, what I did was group Cornell employees who submitted grant applications and who also received grants into five categories. There's $25,000, $25,000 to $50,000, $50,000 to $75,000, $75,000 to $95,000, and $95,000 to $115,000, and $115,000 to $100,000, which basically is it's kind of an equal breakdown. And then I showed what is the average income of each of these groups. Within the group of 0 to 24,000, the median income is about, you know, 22,000. And then they also have to submit their child care costs, and you can see the median child care cost for the group that is 0 to 25,000. They report a median or average income of $6,000, and median is about $5,000. And if, as you go down the income groups, you see that people with higher income can also afford higher costs.
A question. What exactly is the child care costs column 10?
It tells you, people reported that they were asked, how much do you spend, and they had to give the name of the provider. So if you...
I see. It's just the actual cost that they're currently paying, not part of the center, but what they were paying currently or...
Right.
Okay.
But you have to project into the future, and you have to write the name of the child care center. So if you suddenly save $30,000 and you say that you send your child to I-3, there's a way to verify that you're not practices are estimating quite accurately. And these numbers are actually reflecting verified data, so that's after they cleaned it up.
Does any of this matter how many children you have, whether you have one or three kids?
No. It covers basically all your child care costs. So,
per child?
No.
This is a family's child care cost.
So, yeah.
So you have three children, and it would cost you $6,000 for child care?
No, that would be the average of.
Oh, yeah. So it's an average. So it's like a per child, but it's just an average.
No. That $6,000 comes from some families that had three kids and $18,000, and some families that had one kid and $2,000, So, and it came out.
Right. In other words, it's the mean and median of that pool of 20 from the 0 to 25
right.
category, and that pool of 146 from 25 to
correct.
50,000. That's the mean and median of costs of that group.
Right. And you can see that the means are always a bit higher than the median, meaning that there's a whole bunch of people paying more, largely more, right? The distribution.
There are a few people paying a whole lot more.
Yes. And those are probably the people who have more kids.
If someone has children in the child care center, their job is cut. They become unemployed by Cornell. What happens?
In terms of the grant, that was a question. Depending on how it was cut, if the benefits are provided for a year,
they can go into this is called the something. There's all benefits are extended under some. You can still benefit from all benefits under Falcon program or some
Cobra.
The Cobra program this is part of HR's benefits package.
Okay.
But if they were if they departed not on amiable terms, then they're cut off.
No, I mean if Cornell said goodbye, the funding is gone for your job or whatever, the grant is over or whatever, from NIH or whatever.
Right.
Okay.
One more question came to my mind. You said something about when you're talking about the vice provost's children. I don't know whether they have any children now, but they wouldn't qualify because they're above the cap. What cap did you refer to?
$150,000. So I'm assuming he does.
You cannot
apply for the grant.
Oh, okay. But you can apply for a position in the
child care center. Yes.
So that 115, the highest, includes people above $150,000. No, it doesn't.
No, this just talks about the grant.
So it should be 115 to 150.
50, yes.
Okay.
50.
Thank you.
And then you can see kind of the average and median awards, and you see that they were anywhere between 1,300 to the highest earners, of course, get a lower amount. And the out-of-pocket costs are basically calculated as your child care costs minus the award. And finally, I looked at the proportion of income before the award and after the award. So, which the proportion of income was basically your cost over income, and then your cost over income after the award. And what you can see from these data is, first of all, that the lowest, since you all have the table, I'll just... But that the lowest earners at Cornell also pay the highest proportion of their income on child care. Also pay the highest proportion of their income on child care, but at the same time, they're the ones who benefit the most from the grant. And you see that in the difference in proportion before and after the grant. There's issue concerning access to the grant. We find that only 20 families with income lower than $25,000 a year, or 3% of the total grant recipient population, access to the grant. And does that mean that only 3% of the total Cornell population are such low earners? We don't know that. And the question is, and then the committee was concerned, and people were, well, are there people who do not access the grant.
What does access the grant mean?
They don't know what the grant. They don't apply for the grant. And I can tell you anecdotally that when I saw this number, I called. I have a babysitter whose husband works in the kitchen at the kosher dining hall, and I said, and they have three kids, and I said, and I know for a fact that they earn less than 25. And I said, are you applying for the grant? He said, yeah, we got all the paperwork. We don't understand what they want from us, and they didn't. And these people forget probably $5,000 from the child care grant, and it seemed just so overwhelming. You know, there's no photocopy machine at the kosher dining hall. There's no, the paperwork is extremely cumbersome, and so to be fair to HR, they're doing a great job at trying to publicize it now. They're sending many more. You know, in 2003, it was really, you had to be a detective to know about the grant. Now they're doing a very good job. They managed to have people, 60 people, they said, at meetings, at actual meetings where they explained the thing. But we're trying to think about ways that they could actually facilitate. Can you come to HR office, fill it there, photocopy it there, and submit it there? There will be someone who would help you fill those forms. There's all kinds of issues that this, all kinds of support you can provide to people. And also the other thing that people don't understand, I find, is that even if you have a child at school, you can still get money for after-school programs. So after-school programs can cost you $200 a week, which is $800. You know, if you start summing it up, but people think, oh, it's, you know, it's just after-school program compared to where before they paid thousands of dollars a month for infant care.
They get the grant, they can use it to pay for child care anywhere.
Anywhere. They can pay their mother as long as she pays back. Yes, they can pay their mother. Yes.
I'm going to let out my political views. How come the cap isn't substantially lower?
The cap isn't substantially lower because if you notice that even the families, I think, what is the aim that 15% of your income that you won't pay more than 15% of your income, and there are families who earn $150,000 to pay more than 15% in Ithaca.
But percentage is only one way of looking at income, and absolute dollars is justifiable way of looking at it.
Well, this is a question for HR. And if for example they had a flood, if they had a flood of requests from the meatier end of the spectrum, they might have to be less generous with the high end. But that's something that's a decision by HR that probably is consistent with their other benefits policy.
Now,
do you know what, for example, you say 3% of total of income is lower than 25,000. Do you know, for example, what percentage of, say, 95 to 114 access the grant?
It's 65 over 672, so it's about 10%, 9%.
So actually, many more than the lower income.
Yeah. No, it's a real concern.
When you started out, you said that this, you know, they have to generate income because this is for a for-profit organization. So why wasn't it non-profit? I'm not asking you to answer that, but that's an HR question.
There was a bid from the biggest non-profit center in town to run the Cornell Center, and it was considered alongside Bright Horizons offer. That nonprofit center actually had costs that are higher than Cornell's center today. So you'll see this in Table 4. Cornell's prices are high. The Cornell Bright Horizons is high, but in fact, the one that's higher in town is the one
that's
nonprofit. And so we came in on the story with the Child Care Committee after the bidding had been done. But it from what we could tell, it seemed to have been done in a fair way. Cornell actually helped start IC3, this other center.
And they also say that IC3 didn't want replacement with, I can't remember, but the ICC eventually didn't want to take it on themselves because of certain risks that they weren't willing to do.
But I guess what I'm saying, regardless of IC3 or that be a nonprofit, Cornell could say we are nonprofit and these are going to be our levels and our income levels and our, that's what I'm asking.
And it has, the fact that they went for profit, for example, has an effect on what they could do in terms of sliding scale for fee, which they couldn't because that's not how the
That's not true. I don't think that Bright Horizon constrained the choice to go for a non-sliding fee. That was made, Cornell, the coupling between the grant and this new center with the committee was decided that it should have, they shouldn't subsidize at the Bright Horizons because that would give the Cornell families that happen to be lucky enough to get into that center a subsidy that others didn't have access to. So the decision was to make the subsidy for the Cornell Center the same as the subsidy for all child care options, including someone's mother, do it through the grant. Now, that was a tricky decision because at the end of the day, you end up with a huge bill every week, $288 for an infant, and you have to have gotten the paperwork in for potentially 9 months prior to when you first bring your infant there so that you'd have Cornell subsidy. So it means a sliding scale can make a center that's more expensive on average, more accessible to certain parts of the population. And IC3 actually, I believe, pulls that off by having their own sliding scale. The HR and the committee chose this option to be egalitarian about subsidies. And so it seems like a positive choice at that point, but we're now, that may be coming back to bite us.
Just to flip the perspective of this a little bit, Bright Horizon seems to be a competent center, competently run. You know, it's not all about cost. You got to have that. The real key is where does the grant money come from? How do we get more of it? And how do we get the $50,000 and less income percentage down to the 6 to 8% that the upper brackets have? Because the lowest folks have the greatest, frankly, the need to be in class, to be, you know, and have less. So you can go to another daycare center, whatever. They all have pluses or minuses, and they're in a relatively narrow band in affordability. Mm-hmm. The real issue is how do we get this $50,000 and less into a cost share 8.17, in that range, so that they are getting the same relative cost as the other bands. Many ways to do that, and I don't think we're going to solve it here, but that would be my concern.
Well, I think a nice thing about having all of the subsidy in one program, the child care grant, is there's one program to go ask for money for it. You don't have to ask for a little bit of money over here, a little bit of money over there. It's worth noting that in the last year, HR added 70%, went to the Board of Trustees, got an extra 70%, went from something like 800,000, maybe almost 100% increase to 1.4 million for this grant. So I think the University Assembly, if it could formulate a plan, could help that growth that you're talking about. If we could find the ways to motivate those board members to invest in this. HR, this would be a collaboration with HR because, of course, they have to go ask the board, the trustees, for that money. They'd love to have $5 million a year and make all these numbers look crazy. And it's a place where...
And you have to make the link between competitiveness and being able to attract the best and all the things that Mildred Warner writes incessantly about competitiveness of workplaces that provide child care, But if I just can say just one last thing about the current cost of Bright Horizons and our concerns with whether or not it's acceptable to low earners. We don't have the data of who currently is at the child care center, but if you look at the cost of childcare, you see that higher earners pay more than lower earners. And if you actually look at certain brackets, you see that people who earn less than $75,000 on average pay 4 to 5, and people who, even though as high as $115,000, pay on median average $6,000 to $8,000. And if you look at these numbers, you can see that we have a problem. But there's if people couldn't pay before, why would they pay now? And so I think going back and asking for more money for the grant is a great idea. There was an issue about the fact that the grant was capped at $5,000 because of IRS regulations. But I think some of the deliberations in the committee were, well, it's IRS caps it at $5,000, so let's give more than $5,000 and tax people. I mean, people would still be happy to get the additional even after tax. But so far, it's been, except for now, do you want to say something about the bridging grant?
Well, HR also did go and find a pot of money for the people who now have child care because of this new center being open, but weren't here. And in general, this is a yearly problem. There are people who weren't here last year to apply for the child care grant in time because they didn't know they'd live in Ithaca even. And so there's a fall to Christmas gap there that HR has a separate child care grant. Now, right now, that's not covering students.
No.
There's still somebody falling through the cracks there. So that's the second piece of the child care grant. I think that focusing an effort on trying to raise the pot of money, raise the value that Cornell's investing in this would be well spent.
It seems to me there are two things going on. There's raising the pot of money for the child care grant, but there's also the question of where this fits into the center. And we're having questions about both. That is, when you're raising the child care grant, we're talking about wherever you take your child, we give you more money.
Right. Which is representative of the whole Cornell community, not right. Just the 200 families in the center.
Right. And then when we're talking about equity questions with regard to the center, that's a separate body of issues, but it's one that we may want to formulate something about that individual. I have a question about that latter, and that is, the building and the land is owned by Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
Is the center rented to
Bright Horizons?
Bright Horizons. So Cornell gets income from the center.
So Cornell, for a long time, is going to be a net cost for sure, because they're paying off the loans, the building loans, and so on. So
it wasn't a grant that gave them, it wasn't an alumni grant or...
No. There is a possibility that they will find a name.
For the center.
The center will have...
In which event the income that they get from renting it to Bright Horizons, a for-profit company, could...
Well, there's a contract with Bright Horizons that involves a bunch of back and forth on services, so who mows the lawns and... So I don't know whether there's a potential ever for net flowback of these are not the cost of Bright Horizon. An unaffiliated Bright Horizon center would cost 50% again more.
Okay, so they're cutting their rates because...
So there's a subsidy going from Cornell, and that might be the potential profit right there. So they said Cornell gives them rent free buildings. And they...
That's not a number hearing.
No, there was never. But
of course, if you were to take that basic figure of 50% more and compare it to the not-for-profits in town, you would find that the not-for-profits actually are offering the service much lower rate than the Bright Horizons one in the national arena.
Well, Bright Horizons is not a big ugly corporation in this sense. It's not gouging. In that sense, I don't think the fight about who should be running the center is too vital right now. It's my impression. It would cost something like this. There's always a compromise about quality of care and cost, and particular number of child care givers in a room
the ratio of the caregivers to the children, that you can make it cost arbitrarily much high amount of money. This center is actually already a compromise. It is not the gold standard of
quality.
Quality.
So how much does Cornell pay for to run the center?
I don't know that. We never saw it. It was negotiated before we were brought in, and we never saw the contract.
And they've been transferred.
Yeah. And we did at one point see budget numbers for the coming 10 years, and Cornell is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to $1 million a year on financing the project, on paying it off. And that's part of the problem is it took us a while to separate its upfront costs, startup costs, from its annual contributions to subsidize the center. And that's one of the reasons why the child care grant is a good thing, because when you go to the people with money, you can say this isn't for the center, this is for all of Cornell, and they don't see the big dollars disappearing to pay for that new center on the same page as they see this pot of money. This choice, the downside of this choice is table four, which makes the center intimidating to anybody, in particular somebody who has the hope that that child care grant comes in, doesn't necessarily know it's the moment of enrollment, may have to cover a couple months before the child care grant comes in, writing these huge checks.
I think people make choices eventually. I think we'll know eventually, but we suspect that the fact that there's more faculty who didn't decline and that there's staff who declined, and we know it for a fact. There are people who declined because they couldn't afford it, even with the bridging grant.
So it seems like what we could do is leaving the problem of the center and questions of how it's run, who's running, and those kinds of things behind. We could do the resolutions of some sort around a more aggressive, although HR is doing its best, it's doing well, hard, more aggressive attempts to get people below the $50,000 mark enrolled in the child care grant. And B, lowering the rate of people with 50 and below, the cost for proportional cost divided by income after the award, to around 8% from 2017 and 12 and 10. And that means more money, but it also means a much more aggressive attempt to market the grant to staff members and others with salaries or incomes below that level.
And if you did exactly what he said, if that was to happen, ideally if that was to happen, there's no room to take any more kids, is there?
No.
No, we're talking about the grant, though. We're back.
Yeah, we want to leave the center out for the time being.
Okay.
Because what we there's a lot of factors involved in the center, even if the first thing to do would be to lower the proportion of income that's
right,
being paid.
Exactly.
And then that might entice more people to apply aggressively in the staff area for those positions. And then the UA and other agencies could take the stance that that these ought to be more prime applicants. What? Pardon me?
Right. They have priority.
Priority over those with higher incomes because it assists in making Cornell work better, because they'll have on site, they won't have to run and get the kids somewhere else. The things that we talked about at those meetings initially before the center.
But how does how does the UA generate a pressure? Positive pressure in this direction.
That's why I said the word resolution. I think we could, you've even spoken that we could make a resolution that affirms the value of the child care grant, but goes further and says that it seems necessary to address the needs for strengthening Cornell's standing as a
I just
employer.
It'd be nice to have appendices on that resolution that somehow pinned it down and gave it bulk. So this is the kind of thing that can be independent.
Yes,
but if for example in the assembly there could be beyond anecdotes but to numbers about concern. Yeah.
How much of this grant still exists? I mean, did Cornell give the entire grant, give it up and give it out, or is there still money sitting in pot?
On September, actually Friday is the deadline for the next, for the 2000 year. So 3 months before you have to submit, and then they dole it all out. Yeah.
So it's all divvied up in June.
Yeah. So if you arrive in June, or you until the bridging grant, you would be out of luck. So
is like there a bridging grant now ending?
Well, it seems to me that. I don't know if they committed to it annually, but this year there was a bridging grant. But in general, in fact, it's like all other benefits used, it's restricted, and in this case, they spent it all.
Okay, because there are a couple of different points that pertain to that, and that is if you have a limited sum, regardless of how many people apply, with that limited sum that you have, you're going to give it all out to a certain number of people, whether you're late, whether you didn't know about it, or whatever. Everybody. Well, however many people you give it out to and how much money you're giving out per grant is going to determine how many people get it. Right? So, I mean, if the 24, the 50,000 and less group should have either a higher amount given to them or more of them should be given amounts, if you have a fixed sum, if you have a fixed cap or a fixed sum, you're either going to be giving them less to more people or you're going to be giving fewer people more.
Well, I don't. Do you know the algorithm that they use to?
No, I don't. I must tell you, I got the streaks without names, but I got, you know, for each of the 672, and there were some things that were weird to me, that someone with $4,900 got $2,700, and someone with $49,000 annual pay. Got the $2,700, and someone with $8,100, which is, you know, got $3,300. So it didn't. So I didn't actually figure out how that could be.
Well, is it based on maybe one family had one child and the others had two or three in the nursery?
Possibly.
I don't know.
Yeah, and you know your point about the cap. Might, you know, if there's more and more demand for it from lower income, they might have to give less to us.
No, but I think they want to play the percentage game too. So with 115,000 to the highest, whether you want to retain or bring somebody to Cornell, $833.90 is such a tiny percentage of their salary. I can't believe it was a make or break a deal.
They
even care
about
but they
applied. Yeah, but well, if that 833 came from the department that was hiring or retaining, and the 833 here went to the less than 50,000 people, it would make a huge difference.
Yeah.
I think a resolution to ask them to bring that to 75,000. I mean, it just seems like they could. It looks like they're spending more money on those people who are percentage-wise getting much less out of it and have significantly less need.
Right. The thing that's most important to people in recruitment is not. This we discussed this when we were talking about the center before, you know, the committee got. It is having a center nearby. You know, there's a center and there's a place for your child in the center. It's Cornell run or it's Cornell right next to it, and you know, in other words, you're offering
a spot
rather than the money for faculty, at least that's the deal, and maybe for research associates, people in the upper levels of the salary scale. So, and one of the things that HR said in response to that was, this is only phase one. We're thinking of building more. We're thinking of going the next step. I don't know how to enter in. What's that?
But they're in shell shock now.
So yeah, I bet they are. I don't know what an interim step is, but it would seem to me we could either volunteer or put in a note something like, if you do cap at 75, that doesn't mean that you're not encouraging people who are being recruited
yep.
to come here.
A statement from kind of a faculty assembly or us are saying faculty members don't see this as a valuable part of the recruiting effort and retention effort.
Or that that Cornell would go another step, which is to find spots in nearby, if it doesn't have one, in its own daycare facility.
Which they try to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a fair trade-off of having a guarantee of some spots. Well, interestingly, the provost declined to have so-called provost spots at this mission center, which was a surprise, but Vicki was asked, and she declined to have 6 spots reserved for recruiting
persons.
It could be mentioned as trade to suggest that the next provost ask those spots, take those spots, and use them, but that this is not sensible use of this money.
Right. And how can you request more money from larger grant foundations for either another care center that is not profit or one to have an additional grant or money to dig up? Can you submit for private grants or other public grants for that purpose to add to the grant pool that we're not at, rather than just getting it from a loan firm?
I think HR and its benefits, it'd be hard for a nonprofit to go to another nonprofit asking for money for its benefits.
And we discussed that. When we tried to increase the ratios of teachers to students, we tried to find creative ways to finance that, because we argued that the quality of share is a faculty attraction tool, that you get the gold standard rather than the minimum standard, you're more able to attract faculty. And we talked about options, and I think that eventually we said, you know, if going back to the Board of Trustees was the way to go, because it would be very hard to persuade the private foundation. That's
but we should wrap this
yeah.
up. Thank you for coming
thank
in.
You. Thank you.
Can I ask what action, following action, we intend to take?
I'd suggest that the Family and Child Center, since you have statistics, that you come up with a draft resolution for us.
Well, okay, so we should maybe in this position statement, for example, the ideas that we're here can be put into the suggestion, that we get that back to you in its final form, and that can be the basis for drafting a UA resolution.
Yeah. Sorry.
And part of me thinks the resolution, in some senses, should be very simple. That Cornell University be committed to having a child care center that has enough capacity to meet the needs of all students, faculty, and staff, that it is sized, that it can flex to that, and that no student, faculty, or staff should pay more than 8% of their income in the center, and that there should be a capital campaign or other things undertaken to achieve that pot of money to make that goal a reality within 5 years.
The first clause is a deal breaker. I don't think you want to advocate right now expanded Cornell-run daycare center or Cornell on in-site daycare center. One of the things that, for example, came up in the deliberations about this is that there are lots of daycare centers in town, and what Cornell was just going one stage at a time, because it didn't want to flood the, didn't want to take the posture that its responsibility is to care for all the kids that are associated with the Cornell community. So if we kept with the second part, that is having to do with child care grant, I think it's much more workable for you guys, since that's what you're working
well,
on. Right
the, the good thing right now is that HR and the president are both committed to this. In some sense, I think our the role we can play is to give them leverage, when show them that this is on their priority list, show them that it should be higher, and, for example, tell them where they're spending their money suboptimally, and So I think it's something they'd like to be able to go to the ambitious goal right now, but they need to get it on the agenda of board meetings and get it looking like a priority.
Or 75% of the need, or whatever a reasonable percentage. I don't know. You need to keep it simple because we can't solve all the particulars here. But I second the motion of requesting the, I don't know if your committee subcommittee, form a resolution for the general UA's consideration at perhaps the next meeting, if that is possible.
We meet on October 7th.
But for an October meeting, it can be.
I just wanted to suggest that you, you may already have this information, but I'm really curious to know how much unmet need there is for
young
faculty.
They will give us they will.
Because that tells us something about whether the university is serious in using this to attract faculty. We want to get the best faculty. If this would help us, then it's something including that they should put money into the child care.
I think also the UA should encourage the other assemblies to also adopt resolutions in support of this.
I think GPSA would definitely, I mean, looking at the figures that graduate students in our income level are paying. I mean, I know four grad students right now that are pregnant, and I couldn't imagine if I was also having a child to pay well. And on that note, I mean, I think these are all great ideas, but I want to point out that me paying 10% of my income, or me and my wife paying 10% of our income for a child, is a lot different than somebody making 70, 80, 90,000 a year paying 10% of their income, because I'm getting paid enough right now to basically pay for rent and food, and I'm not saving any money. Whereas, you know, somebody making more has the opportunity to pay more. So, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. Nobody should pay more than 8% of their income, but it hurts more for me to pay 8% of my income than maybe somebody else to pay 8%. We should just remember that concept too.
Well, it's a little more complex than that.
So we'll look forward to you guys coming back in October. Give me an idea of what's a good date for you guys to come back.
All right, I will.
Okay.
Thinking of
it. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm going to push up the agenda a little. We need to convene committees. Because we didn't do that last week, did we? Last
time, I thought we did.
There was one in which we did, and I believe, I forget.
Well, we did the Coast and Judicial.
We did?
I just thought.
Okay.
We identified the representatives from here who were charged for the committees.
And I have them from the May meeting. Randy Wayne for Campus Planning Liaison.
We haven't met yet.
Abe Strock from Family Service.
That's meeting.
Yes, that's meeting. Oh, child care.
Child care. Phil Liddick is Family Service.
Okay. And Cade for CJC.
I was a little confused on the exact procedure of starting it for the new year, but I just talked to Kathleen and we're going to have a meeting within the next few days to schedule the first meeting of the year.
Elizabeth Sanders for Budget Planning Committee?
Yay!
Which is what
you're
doing.
No, you have to find it. You're the convener, although they're probably still talking already.
I'm not in charge of convening, but.
Well, you can win. I guess you have to call at the
budget plan.
And Ed, you are going to be the tech.
All right.
Yeah.
Still connected.
Yeah, we'll talk. Yeah, that's one of the really, really dormant ones. Budget plan.
Oh, you're the only one there.
I don't think anybody should look up for funding committee.
And I asked Kathleen to come and give us a preview of what might be on the agenda for the CJC this year.
Yep.
Since it took a lot of our time last year, I figured, well, let's have a preview of what might occupy our time.
Last year, I certainly enjoyed working with you guys in very open and frank conversations that we had. And there was was very productive in that we have a new code of conduct. Hopefully this year will be less exciting. So far, this is what we have on the agenda, and again, we have not yet met, so I don't know what the committee will say about these items, but they're what came in over the summer. Ari had mentioned that the Office of the Judicial Administrator would like a second staffing drive to fill up the student pool and if possibly increase the size of the employee pool. Apparently, the expansion of the pool size for students is because students are less and less available and the number of hearings that the Judicial Administrator calls are increasing. So, Ari, do you want to speak to this at all, or did I
think? You're remembering our conversation more accurately than I am.
I copied your email. Thanks God for email. So that's something that we will be discussing, I'm sure, with the JA. And then Kathy Zoner in the police department, who's on our committee, would like to suggest that we add a violation. And presently, the violation she is suggesting is to bathe in, swim in, or for purposes of swimming and or bathing, enter any waters that are on, adjacent to, or traverse the Cornell University campus, except in those waters officially designated as a swimming or bathing waters. So the
I'm sure
the committee will have a field day working on the language on that.
So we have kids in the water in places that it's not safe for them to be in the water.
My guess is, and again, I have not talked with Kathy, and the committee has not met to discuss this, but I'm guessing part of what her reasoning is behind this is if it gives the university police the option to do something when they see somebody in the waters that are unsafe, it would give them the ability to give them a violation of code and send them to the JA. So I'm guessing
they don't have something if somebody's doing something unsafe.
Well, they, I mean,
the gorge has become such an issue. I have a question. Yes. Does Cornell actually own the water of the gorge? I know they own the paths around, but I'm a little fuzzy as to.
You would have to ask one of the lawyers I work with as to whether water going through an area is actually owned.
And on that note, I know for a fact that Cornell police are not deputized in the city of Ithaca. And so they, if this is not Cornell property, they actually don't have
I believe they're deputized by the sheriff's department.
Maybe, okay.
Yeah.
Because I spoke, because for Halloween stuff, I spoke with the, I guess, chief of police for the city of Ithaca, and he said that Cornell police can't make citations off in College Town for, like, Halloween violations and slope day violations.
Actually, College Town, they can't, can't be.
Well, there's that little caveat we put in there about if it affects the well-being of the university.
Right. And we're talking now about the campus code, not about the...
I'm just wondering if nobody else even has the authority. Just because I want it on record, but I don't think that a student should be cited and sent to the JA for doing something that's not safe for his or her house, like swimming in waters. That doesn't seem like something that should be referred to the JA. That seems like something where... If somebody happens to see them doing it, to for their safety, say, out of the water. Don't do that again.
Oh, I'm sure that, I mean, like I said, we have not discussed this suggestion from the police, and I will certainly ask Kathy to explain the reasoning behind it, but it could be that people don't, you know, I don't know. She just asked to have this violation, the committee has not mentioned it. So.
You know, the drownings always seem to happen in a couple of places where there are dangerous pools of water conditions. I've never understood why they don't just build them up, put rocks in there, put concrete in there, keep it from getting so far down that you can't stand up when you're in that pool because of the water. Because it's deceptive. People don't know those holes are there, right? But something can be done about those rather than banning people from going to water, which they've been doing from the time immemorial, which is a big part of the attraction of going to school.
Well, I was going to say, it is odd that the boardroom does have a picture of people in the gorge.
And
yeah.
But I wasn't going to say anything to
Well, this is going to cover the CPC.
This is going to go to the CPC.
Will debate, we'll bring us a resolution, a proposal, and we'll have to debate it. So
and trust me, the CPC, in all the years I've been on the CPC, is very good at going through the language and trying to look at all. One of the things about the Coach and Judicial Committee is it's a very representative of faculty, staff, students, as well as police officer in the JA, so we will get all sides of the issue.
This is also a community issue, I think, which the CJC may want to...
The Cornell community?
No, all the people that do use, like, flat rocks.
Well, this is just talking about the code
of... students for violation.
It's the code of the campus community, so we're working on. We don't have... We can't touch the city code service. This is just a code of conduct for the university.
If I take my family there, I can get JA for my kids.
Only if they're near Cornell and
Eaton. Possibly.
I can't just say I don't know what you're talking about.
Another thing that was brought up by a student is that the idea that defamation, libel, and slander be added to the code is violation. And he would like to come to the Coach and Judicial Committee to discuss that. And then a professor... said he's concerned about the concept of, quote, reputational interests of the university itself, end quote, as one of several interests and purposes that the university must protect and promote, according to text in the new code of conduct. He would like to have the notion of reputational interests be reconsidered.
Well, you know those passages. I don't think reputational interest is anywhere in the code.
Yeah, I think it is. This came in during the summer. I can't remember, but I believe I looked it up, and it is in there.
Not the word reputational interest.
Is it in the old part of the code, or is it
new?
I think it's in the new, but... Ari, is the new code up somewhere?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
If you Google Cornell Code of Conduct, you will find it.
Is it searchable?
We just got that note from Tommy Bruce saying, watch out what you're doing.
Right. I don't really know. I mean, if the committee does discuss this, we would probably ask the person to come in and explain why he wanted us to know.
Yeah.
But that's what come in over the phone, which is sort of interesting because in all my years on the CJC, I don't remember these many things coming in over the phone where people wanted to talk about. Yeah.
Has there any been any effect of the COVID on how things have worked, any positive or negative?
That probably would be a question for the JA, because she's the one who actually sees, you know, the code actually in action and the people get violated. I don't know the answer to that question.
I sort of know that, I think.
And?
I can't remember what she said. I think she said actually cases are up.
Well, she does
want
school
degrees,
so.
Right. But I'm going to put her on our agenda.
Of course, thanks.
Are you done?
I'm done.
Oh, okay.
Now, do you guys have anything you want to add to that?
Anything for Kathleen? This will be a good way to segue. And there's a handout over there of what our meetings are scheduled for the next academic year. I tried to put some topics on there that we discussed at the executive committee, what we were interested in. I'm looking to see if there's anything in particular that you guys are interested in that we may want to add to a meeting.
What is climate?
Okay.
It's the new committee, and I probably didn't use the right terminology. I did? Okay.
No. Okay.
Just once.
Okay. Yeah.
It's, I'm sorry, what did you say?
Human resources committee. And there'll be a survey going out at some point. That's all that we really know.
Okay.
The employee assembly was asked for one representative. So, and actually, Bill Litick is on there, so he'll
And Bill couldn't be here tonight because he had a death in his family. So.
Do we have
room in
the not that this is going to be encouraged, but we just saw a student was just hit on Jeff's ball last Friday. I don't know whether she's alive or dead. She was terribly injured, riding a bicycle down to the fall. And I've been very concerned for 50, the 15 years I've lived here that we don't have bike paths, we don't have bike lanes, we don't even have sidewalks on so many of the major arteries around here. So we're not really encouraging people to walk and bike because it's not safe.
The person, the people who could speak to that are David Lee and Bill Wendt.
Okay.
And the Transportation Committee.
Yeah.
Well, he was on, he didn't mention anybody. So Dan Brown was on the Transportation Committee. Did somebody say?
That is.
Good.
Yeah.
And perhaps we can have them come and talk to us once you guys get going and see what's on the agenda.
But yeah, no, actually, I would agree with you. Pedestrian unfriendly area.
It's a very unfriendly pedestrian bike, and when all our talk about sustainability just means nothing when we make it so scary to walk and bike.
Yeah, we don't even have. I'm sorry, I'm going to try and even on just a guess here. I biked on that path, that's why I'm trying to. We don't even have lights around there, so if you happen to be going around at night.
Around
some areas in the around the area of Jed Falls. Not specifically Jed Falls, some of the roads and I don't have enough. I don't have light.
That's going on problem.
Well, part of it is a campus road, I think, and part of it is in the jurisdiction of the town. But it's, I mean, if Cornell wanted to say, let's build a bypass down Fordham Drive, Pleasant Road, Warren Road.
Sure. It would
and jump off, yeah, but we just got people here, and somebody terribly injured, may not even be alive anymore, a young woman, hit by a car, riding her bike. We want you to do.
Okay. Can we make a resolution that says that people will be JA if they walk or ride a bike to the school because it's so unsafe?
More people will probably hurt that way than on the course.
It's not brandy. Okay, so if you have topics, you can email me or Mark or Marty or
stuff. She just recommended this topic. Yeah. Is that going to become
a
part of the
decision? True commitment to sustainability and alternatives to driving by making it safe and beautiful and pleasant and wonderful to bike and walk.
This should be run through TAC.
I think both TAC and budget planning.
Campus planning and TAC.
Both you should bring those both to the campus planning and the TAC committee. That is what. No, I mean, so that these policymakers in those committees will respond with what the limitations are, or you know, just the way here at Cranman Shot, they brought us a body of information, which we then could speak to and make some recommendations about more money for blah blah because the following things inequities exist. And if transportation says yes, we want to have bicycle paths, we want to have lighting, we want to, but we don't have the requisite university support, then we can have a resolution which says supported by the transportation or in support of, just the way we did for the T guys. I think, and that's for campus transportation. And then in planning, the same thing. When you ask the planners, you know, what is your, in planning the future shape of things?
Well, you know, the master plan contemplates connecting bike lanes with ramps up and down stairs so people can just zoom right in on their bikes and be safe and have covered parking for all the snow and rain and so on. And I just don't see it really happening at all.
Well,
we're losing bike racks.
No, I know. So that's the thing to do then is citing that and citing data from the Campus Planning Committee and Budget and Planning Committee, find a resolution we can put some heat rather than just say we want more bike racks or we want more bike things. I mean, it would seem that's important to, but to have the data behind it, which is based in the committee and the policymakers' deliberations.
Well, are you suggesting that we get somebody to come and give us the data here and we can decide?
No, I'm suggesting that in your committee, the Budget and Planning Committee,
I bring this up there.
Well, that you ask them to take a stand on it, and you ask them what the limitations are, and why is it that the campus plan, this particular thing, which is not a long-range need, it's a present current need, can't be addressed right now. And if they, as a member of the committee, you have a right and a responsibility.
Yeah, but if I could go and say, you know, I'm here from the UA, and we've discussed it, and we have, you know, and we've heard some data, we've heard some information, and we have a resolution that we have a strong position, and just, oh, it's a little defender's thing talking about fighting.
Well, I think you can, because we've discussed it, and everybody seems to agree with you.
If we can put it on the agenda, maybe, you know, fairly soon, maybe even move it up, I don't know what I'd bump it, maybe campus door, you know.
Maybe the agenda on the day that has TAC coming. That's on there, right? Or transportation. So that was going to say.
It is not.
Oh, it's not. It's
no.
Not.
Can
so we bump campus store a little lower if it's not urgent and put
our services or is it everybody's schedule?
But like with TAC, he needs to be able to get there before the meeting. Before our meeting.
Yeah, I mean, I want to contact you, get some ideas from you, and then
concerning like committee staffing, because I know one of the bottlenecks right now is that in order to be in the committee, you need to have people staffed in the committee.
Mm-hmm.
That should be coming out in the next week or two, so you should be able to.
It's reasonable. It seems reasonable since we have a meeting in November and we have a meeting in December that are still to be determined, that there is time to get these other committees that have the, it is within their jurisdiction of conversational topics to convene, to bring these to the table of things to discuss in their committee, and then when you think that you have some footing on these particular topics, and you can talk amongst yourselves to have co-occurrent conversations that run between your committees, and that's fine. If you want to be together, that's fine too. And then when you have your thoughts connected with information from each other's committees and perhaps sending a message out to transportation, you know, and campus planning committees and gather data from there to put together a nice presentation, and we'll have it November or December or perhaps sooner if you get it sooner. For now, I think it would be smarter to keep the things on the agenda as they are, reserve it for November or December to say, We're encouraging you to get your act together for those meetings. And
I'm just assuming that both of our committees are probably going to be meeting pretty soon, because these are
great,
big permanent important committees. And if there is a place where conveniently and nobody schedules in someone, if we could move this issue up a little earlier so that you and I could go to these broad university important powerful committees and say, look, we've had a discussion in the UA. So we're not just individuals.
Well, you're not just individuals. So, and I don't want to take the floor from you, Rodney, but I just want to suggest that part of the event, I'm sorry, I'm using a little bit of leverage here, to say convene, and having brought it to the table and now getting other people's feedback from the UA, yes, you can go back to these places and say, we discussed this at the UA, they are interested to hear what we have to say. Now we're motivated to get the data together, to put a presentation together. They're willing to hear us sooner if we can get it together sooner. Otherwise, we're going to be here in November. So I will put it out there. Does anybody have an objection to move campus store a little lower if they can get things together within the next 2 weeks?
Or how about if we include it on the same day as Gorge Safety, since we're talking about
safety.
Yep.
Just to
make it a safety day.
That seems like a very procedural discussion. Part of the reason you have an executive committee is so that if, say, Professor Sanders meets with the budget planning committee and it becomes an urgent topic, the agenda can be reconfigured outside
right.
of this meeting. By that's why you have a chair and a vice chair who are designated to handle those questions.
Keep me updated on email. And we'll work it in as necessary. How's that?
What's your email address?
It's on the sheet.
The membership sheet.
Okay.
To be honest, a lot of these, Academic Integrity actually doesn't have an update as I thought it would. There's only the ad hoc charter review committee, and we can even discuss that in exact word a little bit more. That's kind of a more procedural thing as well.
not to steal your thunder here, but
that's all right.
Perhaps I would like to just spend the last of the discussion. 6 o'clock or 6:30?
6:30.
It says
6:30 on the sheet because I put that because I wasn't sure. It's 6. Okay, so
we need to do minutes from May.
From last meeting.
Can we do that and get it out of the way?
Yeah.
And then we'll
take a couple minutes to discuss the people something because we have a pretty important meeting and call it a day, I guess.
So?
Motion to approve.
Yeah. Motion to approve.
There was just a change. I was on the academic.
Actually, we'll go to the last page. Oh, this is you. Jay Blair and
I don't know. Did you volunteer?
No, it was just
I did volunteer. And
what did I volunteer for?
You did it.
I think we did it for the academic.
You almost so you almost got approved into it.
Okay. Any more questions?
In that list of committees, you said something about Abe Strzok being the family services. Where was that? Because it should be changed if it's not.
That was from the May 5th.
Right, isn't that? Oh, it's not September 5th. Okay, thanks. Great.
Any other questions? All in favor?
What was the last one they said?
That was no problem.
We were talking about the May 5th.
May 5th. Mm-hmm.
So it's just removing your name on page
4 to save up some rent. Jay Blair and R. Wayne volunteered to help with this.
Good. Thank you.
Also,
motion
to approve. Seconded?
Second.
All in favor?
You have to say who first did it and who seconded it because I can't see. Save the report.
Jay Blair, first.
Hatch.
Hatch for second.
Thank you.
And going back to your topic.
And would you like to
keep us up?
With an update?
Very quickly, since we formed our last meeting, an ad hoc committee to look at the concerns of PeopleSoft, we met via email several, 8 times a day. What we came up with is we want to talk to the key stakeholders and essentially answer two questions. Is PeopleSoft meeting the basic needs of the university, in other words, the purposes with which it was built or purchased for, and then is it meeting user expectations? It took us a while to kind of narrow it down back, looking at the scope of UA authority and things, and then it's taken us a while to figure out who these key stakeholders are. Yesterday, two days ago, we met with Susan Murphy and Holly McClure. They were both very helpful and spent a lot of time, very, very generous with their time, telling us how it was all assembled and the key business areas that were affected, and we have a set of names now. I don't know that we necessarily want to read them into the record, but that we're going to go contact and actually eventually get this data from. I will tell you that it was the sense of all three of us after meeting with Susan Murphy that we felt much more confident that the PeopleSoft ship, as it were, is being well steered. And that really, of course, we need to talk to these folks and see if there's some countervailing thought processes. But also, I think we want to look at some of the priorities at which they're going to bring things on and fix some things. We may have some community input that would move some things up, like student advisement, which right now has a kind of an undefined target of several years from now potentially. To really bring it on, some of the registration things appear to be fixed. They are doing some heavy beta testing to make sure the system doesn't crash in the next go around. I guess the bottom line is everybody thinks PeopleSoft isn't perfect yet. They do have a plan to work it. The associate and assistant deans pretty much head the group to set the priorities and meet on the PeopleSoft agenda. We will be communicating with them as well as the key business elements, and we'll report out again, I suspect, probably next meeting with more concrete agendas and whether there's something more concrete that this assembly, whether we should form a resolution or memo to anybody or not. Questions? Did I skip past? Did I confuse anybody or whatever? Key thing is PeopleSoft isn't broken. It's not where we want it. There is a strong team working it. And other than perhaps some of their prioritization, the orders in which they're fixing things.
See, I should have just listened to me the last meeting, and that would have been all right.
quick question. Did you get a sense? So, before they went live, they've been developing this platform for a couple of years, probably, right?
You mean university or PeopleSoft?
University, talking with PeopleSoft like Oracle. Right?
12 years.
So, it's been 12 years in the making. And so, I mean, did you get a sense of how, if it's 12 years in the making and it crashes, how fast is it? How many years does it take to get this thing actually flowing, flowing, good?
You know, first you're asking the unknown and unknowable,
yeah.
But I get the sense that they are spending an awful lot of resources to ensure that it did crash. One of the things that Susan Murphy said was that they normally do registration a week. They really got it done when it was up. They got it done in 2 days. And when it was up, it worked very well. The crash was a concern, and they had done a lot of testing to, you know, prevent that. Part of the, you know, it's been 12 years, but you got 7 very independent colleges at Cornell,
mm-hmm.
and each of them implemented some a lot more customized than others, and there's some lessons learned in that.
There's more than
that. Yeah, so the bad news is that Susan Murphy said she thinks it's going to take a year of running to find out what's wrong. And although it seems to me, I think it probably seems to us that she had heard after registration that there's a nightmare. And she's heard from faculty that the revised part is a nightmare. And she seems genuinely concerned. So they had adjust their budget to use stock this part or customize that, and they made certain decisions not knowing the future. But now they know the future a little bit. They know the present, and maybe you can have some influence in resetting the priorities for the things.
And the reality is the process that, as she and Paula McClure, the head of Cornell IT, agreed, they're in line with that. I mean, the reality is users are really the ultimate beta test in today's world. The platform seems to be viable, stable, but your first implementation of any new platform is going to be worse than all the custom things it replaces. You know, that's a sad fact. So they fully understand the warts, the concerns, the worry. They are, in my opinion, diligently working through that. But it will take some.
Some time. The department staff, the administrative staff in our department is just going crazy. It's just driving us into tears. With all the things they have to do that now are so much more complicated, it takes so much longer.
See, we get
room inside us.
The only thing I would add to that is that there are some departments that I've spoken to who say, oh yeah, it's simplified my life. Yeah, so there's a college-by-college answer, and just let me say that this is still a work in progress. We have not interviewed these other key business things. We haven't talked to the associate assistant deans, and they may paint either a different picture or a specific college.
The number of majors, the number of classes.
Well, there was definitely one college that, at least from the Cornell standpoint, or Susan Lippert calling the third standpoint, did not invest as much pre-capital as perhaps the other 6 did, and may have suffered from that.
Do you think there's any value added in addition to talking to the president, the vice presidents and all those folks, to talk to the people that actually in the trenches that are really using this, because I hear what you hear.
I'll be in the trenches.
Yeah.
We will reach out to those folks. You know, we understand there's two sides to everything. Mm-hmm. You know, in some cases, the people who are experiencing aren't talking necessarily to the right forums. And I think we'll get some ground truth. And I'm sure it will not all be pretty. The question is it known? When's it scheduled for fix? And is the glide slope realistic for that?
Was there any mention as to why the vendor is PeopleSoft as opposed to someone else?
We didn't engage in that. I mean, PeopleSoft.
Yeah. I know it's a done deal, but I'm just saying, did they give any history or background?
I get the sense again that they did a search. They had to make decisions, and I mean, I don't think it's really for us to reopen that.
I'm not saying reopen it. I'm just saying to understand why that.
Cornell had been involved in data testing of PeopleSoft 12 years ago, along with six other colleges. So we've been really closely affiliated with them.
And it wasn't the only system.
There's a reason why.
That wasn't the only system that was looked at. I can tell you that. I can tell you there was two others.
Good and bad. The fire department census is taking PeopleSoft and it comes online in a year. Mm-hmm. So at least you're with a company that who's got enough money that's going to be around for a while.
Anything else?
Remains
often. Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good name.
Seth Cardo. Leanne Lawrence seconded.
608.
Yeah.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.